Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we revisit the guys behind Talk Like a Pirate Day. We have an audio postcard from the U of I's annual Quad Day. We meet with local magician and escape artist Andy Dallas, who has recently been named as the president of the Society of American Magicians. And we find out what life is like being the editor of the personal section of a big city newspaper. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. If you don't have September 19th already circled on your calendar, well, you're probably not a fan of this show, or of pirates. Those in the know that every September 19th is International Talk Like a Pirate Day. The concept is pretty simple. You spend the day talking like a pirate. For the last couple of years, we've checked in with the guys behind Talk Like a Pirate Day, John Bauer and Mark Summers, to find out what they're up to. I talked with them this week and asked them if there are any special events planned for this year's Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Well, we've got a variety of things going on. First of all, we've been running a contest on our website, talklikeapirate.com.
And who's
been running a contest all summer called Buccaneer Bachelor, where we started with 22 women competing for the heart, the hand, or some other piece of Cap'n Slappy.
Hey, they can have any piece they like.
Well, who do we just hear from? Who do we just hear from?
This is Old Chumbucket.
Okay.
And I'm Captain Slappy.
And so the contest is for Captain Slappy.
Aye.
So how did this come about?
Well, my own wife, Mad Sally, the official lusty pirate wench, was watching the show The Bachelor on TV and said, we could do that. And she was right. Now, we weren't able to sell the show idea to a TV network, so we did it ourselves on the website. And the women write in every week. We pose a different challenge to them. And one by one, they're eliminated until we're down to near perfection in piratitude wenchiness.
And, of course, they also get fabulous prizes.
Fabulous prizes.
Fabulous
Not just
prizes.
Slappy, but something actually worth something.
Aye.
So how far along is the contest right now?
Well, right now we're down to four wenches. And on September 19th, we'll pick the lucky winner.
And lucky she will be.
Especially since the contest rules specify that she doesn't actually have to marry Captain Slappy.
Or even meet me.
Or even be in the same time zone.
No, she doesn't.
So to recap, for those who have never experienced Talk Like a Pirate Day before, just give us a quick 30-second thumbnail sketch of what this thing is all about.
Well, Talk Like a Pirate Day is a day when the world, the entire world, is joined in one concept, that we can all talk like a pirate. Maybe we can't all get along, but we can all say, arr!
Now, according to your website, you also have something going on the day before Talk Like a Pirate Day, and that is an appearance on the ABC show Wife Swap.
Aye, that we do.
Aye.
Now, Cap'n Slappy, we're trying to find him, the perfect wench, but I already have the perfect pirate wench, Mad Sally, and she and I took part in the wife swap, where a professional organizer came to our house to live for the two-week period, and Mad Sally went down to their very organized home and tried to instill a little piratic chaos.
We call it wench swap now.
Although, now, Cap'n Slappy took part as well. He features very prominently in several key scenes.
I insinuate myself.
I don't want you to, give away any of the drama that ensued, but how did they react to the pirates?
I think they were baffled. That would be the word I would use.
I would have to say that it would be fair to say that there won't be Christmas cards passing back and forth betwixt our families. I think they were rather surprised. I'm sure they expected chaos and disorder wherever the other family was, but I don't think they were expecting pirates.
You know, this seems to be a big year for you guys, not just the wife swap appearance and the Captain Slappy Bachelorette thing, but, you know, Disney had another big blockbuster this summer with another pirate movie, and it seems you guys are the people to call whenever anybody needs a pirate expert or pirate opinion.
We're riding that wave for a while longer. Yes, we are.
So, I mean,
Disney was able to have a pretty big hit without our help. Imagine how big that would have been if they'd had the sense to call us in as advisors.
That's right.
For those out there who feel that there is no bit of piratitude in their life, and piratitude is pirate attitude, a term that you guys have coined, how can somebody add that to their life? What are some simple ways that somebody can add some piratitude into their lives?
Well, it kind of starts with the swagger. You don't have to be a pirate to have a pirate swagger. And that's just the walk that says, I'm here, I'm alive, and watch where I put my feet.
It all starts inside you. It all starts with that sense that you're living life on your own terms, not answering other people's expectations. And if they like it, they can be your mates. And if they don't like it, well, pirates need something called prey, don't they?
I also see on your website that you guys are really branching out. I know you have a couple of books already, right? The Piratitude book being the latest.
Right.
And this appearance on TV, and now ringtones for your cell phone.
That's right.
You can download a free ringtone. If what you really need to make your life complete is Cap'n Slappy and Old Chumbucket shouting at you from your telephone,
ahoy!
Well, then you can go to our website and download such a thing.
Aye, that's right. Go to talklikeapirate.com and get yourself a ringtone.
That seems like a very modern thing for pirates.
Well, we're living in the 21st century. We may pretend it's the 17th, but we're living in the 21st century.
We're pirates with a website, so watch out.
And we know how to use it. Now, here's another very strange thing that happened this year, and it hasn't borne fruit yet, but you never know. We had a meeting, a telephone meeting, about 5 months ago with a composer and lyricist who were talking about making our book, Piratitude, into Piratitude the Musical.
Hey!
Really?
Really. We actually put together a plot. We'd write the book and they'd write the music. Now, we haven't heard back from the lads in about 5 months now, so maybe they're not so keen on the idea as they once were.
But it worked for them pirates from Penzance.
That is true. There have been some great pirate and seagoing musicals and shows.
Well, now, coming up in October, just upstate there in Chicago, there's the first performance of a musical called The Pirate Queen is scheduled, and that's written by the guys who wrote Les Miserables.
Will you guys be there for the performance?
If only. If only. Once again, they neglected to take the obvious success to ensure, the step to ensure their success, and that's to invite us.
We have far too much stage presence. We're intimidated in that way.
Well, are you guys still having fun being pirates?
We're just a couple of big goofs. We're having a great time.
I mean, do you wake up in the morning and say, my life is based on being a pirate, you know?
It is surreal.
We get up in the morning, have our rum and orange juice, and say to ourselves, I can't believe we're pirates.
I can't believe we're getting away with this, is what we say.
So this Talk Like a Pirate Day, September 19th, where will you guys be?
Well, that's the question of the hour. We're not really sure. There's talk of us going places, but we've been told not to say anything about it until it happens.
Nothing's nailed down yet, but the whole ABC thing has kind of opened a couple of doors for us that we're hoping don't get slammed on our noses.
Now, if it's a typical Talk Like a Pirate Day, then we'll start our interviews the day before with Australian radio stations and work our way around the world by telephone.
It'll be a busy day for you guys, no doubt.
It'll be a busy day.
Christmas is busy for Santa Claus, and Talk Like a Pirate Day is busy for the pirate guys.
Aye.
So when Pirate Day actually hits, how many interviews do you guys wind up doing?
What was the number last year?
Last year, in 32 hours,
from noon on the 18th until 6 o'clock the evening of September 19th, we did 84 interviews.
Wow.
And that was with a drive up to Portland to do a TV appearance and then a drive home.
That's staggering.
We were staggered.
We were staggered.
Well, for those who want to celebrate Talk Like a Pirate Day, what do they need to know, and where can they find out all this information about Pirate Day?
Well, they need to know that they'll need our book, Piratitude, in
they'll
order
need,
to be really good at this.
They'll need several copies, because they make great gifts.
Aye, that they do. No toilet should be without our book. And they should visit our website, talklikeapirate.com.
But what they need to know is just that it's okay to have fun. It's okay to be a little anarchic and a little crazy and just have fun with it.
Well, hopefully we'll be able to talk with you guys again next year, and hopefully the pirate empire will have grown by then.
We can only hope.
Aye.
I still have 3 kids to put through college,
and I've got a treasure chest to fill.
Well, John and Mark, thanks a lot for talking with us again about International Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was John Bauer and Mark Summers, the creators of International Talk Like a Pirate Day, which, of course, is September 19th. This is Sidetrack. Vendors, scary rides, and of course, the animals. All familiar sounds at the Illinois State Fair. But for reporter Carvitha Cardoza, it wasn't so much what she heard at the competitive eating contest as what caught her eye.
The music may have drowned out sounds of the 11 competitors chewing and chomping down on their food, but it couldn't blot out the sight of them gobbling down Springfield's specialty, the horseshoe. That's toasted bread stacked with hamburger patties and a mound of French fries doused in gooey cheese sauce. Not that the fans that packed the venue were complaining. The atmosphere was a little surreal as they cheered on their favorites.
Welcome to the stage, please. Rank number 6, 10, Eros Yellows.
Referee Eddie Dunn listed the rules as competitors stood in front of their individual foil pans. They would be judged on the weight of food they could eat in 10 minutes. They would be disqualified for dropping food on the ground or hiding it in their napkins. And they would be out of the running if there was what Dunn euphemistically called a reversal of fortune.
If someone has an emancipation esophagation, they are immediately disqualified.
In the end, Joey Chesnut devoured the competition. Dubbed the Enigma of the Esophagus on the competitive eating circuit, he's a construction engineer from California who came to the Illinois State Fair specifically for this contest. He's ranked number 2 in the world and is quick to list his gastric accomplishments.
I've won the grilled cheese eating championship with 47 grilled cheese sandwiches. I've done bratwurst. Last week I did 45 bratwursts in 10 minutes. Done 52 hot dogs and buns in 12 minutes. 118 jalapeno poppers in 10 minutes.
Chesnut ended up chowing down 6.5 pounds of horseshoes, and for his efforts, he won $2,000. He says in less than a couple of years, he's almost saved up enough to buy a house. Most eaters dunk their food in water to help it go down easier. Tim Janis from New York, who came second, is dead serious when he says a little bit of lemonade, not water, is what helped him.
Well, that's actually my contribution, my legacy to the sport was the alternative beverage movement, which was everyone used water until I came along, and I realized that iced tea was a good complement to the foods we're eating, and then I realized that lemonade cuts grease, or cuts the taste of hot dog, like Palmolive cuts grease.
James Davis is from Springfield. With a big cheesy grin, and I mean that literally, he admits he was mistaken when he thought he had a hometown advantage. Unlike the winners, Davis has tasted horseshoes hundreds of times before. He says he didn't eat for 2 days before the contest, but it was harder than he imagined to eat Springfield's favorite dish with his fingers. Still, he says he tried.
Eat smaller bites, faster, and eat the bread first. That'll fill you up the first.
Referee Dunn says the messy horseshoes gave contestants the most trouble he's seen in a while. Dunn says practically every place has their own favorite speed-eating dish.
Let's see, there's crab cakes in Maryland, there's onions in Maui, there's oysters in Maine, lobsters in Maine, hot dogs is the big event on 4th of July, Coney Island, there's rancheros in Bermuda. Basically whatever town has a specific food, they will have a contest at some point.
Ignoring what some people have warned are the health risks attached to eating large amounts of food in a short period of time, competitive eating is becoming a more popular event, even showcased on ESPN. The number one ranked champion in the world is Japanese Takeru Kobayashi, who ate 58 hot dogs earlier this year in 10 minutes. Dunn says people love what they know. He says in the same way NASCAR is popular because everyone drives, competitive eating contests attract fans because people love food. He bristles at the suggestion that this may not quite be a sport the way most people understand it. He insists it is, and it's been around for ages.
Competitive eating, if you think about it, goes back to the beginning of time, even in caveman days. There's three cavemen in a cave and a chicken walks in. That's a competitive eating event right there.
Gurgitators, as they like to be called, or gluttons. For many, the answer isn't so elementary. I'm Kavitha Cardoza.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Andy Dallas is enthusiastic about magic. In the back room, the magic room of his downtown champagne store, Dallas & Company, he shows off the variety of tricks and props he has available there.
Her hand is there, so, and then you can open up that little box in the middle while she's over to that side and literally see her inside that area over there. And it's, we call those illusions, and they're usually done with people. Although all this is illusion, you know, these are what we specifically, it's kind of the trade name for that. Beautiful, beautiful effect.
In July, Dallas was named as the 90th president of the Society of American Magicians. He's the first escape artist magician to hold that position since Harry Houdini did in 1926.
The Society of American Magicians was founded in 1902, and it was in a local club in New York City, in a place called Martinka's Magic Shop. And Harry Houdini, in 1916, became president, and he began to make it a national organization. And then over the years, it went from national to becoming a worldwide organization with the second largest and oldest magic organization in the world. And we have 7,000 members in over 50 countries. So that's a pretty exciting a wonderful organization with a tremendous history to be a part of and much less to be president of. 13 years ago, I had the opportunity to start working totally unintentionally within the political structure of this. And over the years, I've done all kinds of things within this group, and including producing kids shows that went to Las Vegas and New Orleans and New York City, all the way up to becoming president. And this year, I take on the presidency and represent the 7,000 wonderful members all over the world as the president of the Society of American Magicians.
Now, according to the press release, you are the first escape artist magician since Houdini to be the president?
That's correct. In the early 90s, I was nominated as one of the top escape artists in the world. I did my first major escape here in Champaign-Urbana off of University Inn, which at that time was called Century 21. And we did it in 1976, hanging from that building upside down, and did the famous straitjacket escape made by Harry Houdini in front of over 4,000 spectators here, and it was a real big event. And from there, I went all over the world doing escapes. I was on the number one television show in Europe. I've been underwater and submerged underwater in chain shackles, locks, and boxes. I've been suspended from helicopters, cranes, and skyscrapers, and it's been a crazy, crazy life. Now I'm getting a little old to be doing all that stuff, so I'm now pretty much involved in a more subdued type of magic and magic for the peers. And I still do a spirit act that's very popular among the magicians and of course, the public. And it's a lot of fun.
So how does one start to become a escape artist?
Well, the first thing you have to do is basically, by the way, magic is, we have a saying in magic that the most well-kept secrets are in books. And that's true. So we have more written per capita about magic than just about any other subject in the world. There are over 7,000 magic books, maybe 8,000 now. It happens so quick. And then there's all the DVDs and all the educational material. Magic is completely about learning and practicing and performing all these secrets. And in order to get the secrets, you have to go explore what these secrets are. There are books and literature on that, and we are on escapes, and you can read about Houdini, and we have a very rich history in this, and you begin to kind of pick up what these guys did and how they did it, and once you know those concepts, you can start to become one of these people and use your own imagination and skills and creativity to produce whatever effects you want.
What's the number one lesson you have learned as an escape artist? To always have the key hidden?
Actually, the number one lesson is to be safe. If you're doing like the big escapes, the handcuff things, that you're just doing for the fun of it and what have you, that's one thing. But the kind of escapes that I was doing off of helicopters and underwater, you have to make sure that you built in as much safety as you can. However, there are times when, things go wrong. And that's when, there have been guys who, there was one magician who was doing a burning rope thing and it broke, another magician broke his fall from a building, from the front of a building, and he will forever be impaired by that. So we have to be very careful, because then it becomes very hard to book this again, and insurance goes up and all these kinds of things. So the biggest lesson that I think anyone needs to learn to become an event escape artist, someone who does serious escapes, is to really make sure that you're safe and that you try to do as much safety as you possibly can during those events, and make sure you practice and know your limitations on this. One time somebody was buried in a plexiglass box which collapsed under concrete. never having done it before, never tried it. They even glued the box shut with super glue. That isn't going to hold up under tons and tons of concrete. So we have to be very careful and make sure we test these things and go in with as much knowledge and as much safety as we possibly can. Again, that doesn't protect you from everything, but it certainly does. It certainly should be the credo of any escape artist.
Now, I see up there is a straitjacket. Is that sort of the basic element to all escape artists? Is that sort of the foundation for a lot of escape artists?
I think that that's probably the symbol of it. You know, the Harry Houdini's escape from a straitjacket has become the number one image that one sees them in when they want to become an escape artist, or that people think about when they think about an escape artist. You think about a straitjacket escape. And that particular escape jacket is one of mine that I did years ago. Probably that's almost 30 years old, and I've escaped off of all kinds of things with that jacket. So I keep those things around just for the fun of it. You can see that it's pretty worn. That one, I think, went down a water slide that we did an underwater thing in a swimming pool and all kinds of stuff. It's just been a lot of fun trying to do this stuff. And then we're such a small group that you don't have colleges you can go to learn this stuff. So it's all mentoring, and that's what makes the Society of American Magicians so wonderful. It's a mentoring group. It's a group that we can connect with. It's a group that we can speak to each other on, you know, and they have a big convention every year, and we get together and network, and we have the premier youth organization, of which I'm on the board. How wonderful is that? I mean, I just live a wonderful life in this magical world.
What sort of issues does the society deal with? I know you talked about teaching and mentoring. What are the big issues right now in magic societies?
Well, our society is very much in favor of keeping the magic secrets, and always has been. That's been a big issue with us. So we are very much against any gratuitous exposure. We also are very much involved in making sure that we use our magic in other ways that helps the public. For example, when Katrina hit, we sent magicians into that area, and they entertained people who were in shelters and so forth, and raised money to provide children, toys for the kids that were displaced. So we have that. We have a thing called the Houdini Fund. I love this, that allows any magician, whether you're a member of the Society of American Magicians or not, to get a grant, a gift, basically, of a certain amount of money that would allow them, while they're in the hospital or while they're convalescing, some creature comfort. If they need a wheelchair, or if they need, we don't pay their medical bill, but we use it for anything that would make them more comfortable. And that was started by Harry Houdini, who would buy many old magicians a box of cigars. And over the years, they built an endowment on that, and now we have this this wonderful fund that can be given to any magician, whether they're members or not. I think that's a really neat idea. We also are very veteran oriented, and we have veterans. A program that goes out to the veterans' hospitals and performs. We have Magic Week, which is the last week of October, of which we are working very hard to make it a national Magic Week day, or Magic Week that's recognized by the government. So that's coming up, I think, very soon. We've been working really hard on that issue, and that sends magicians to nursing homes and to youth centers and just tries to bring magic to people who otherwise would not get an opportunity to see it. We also have one more thing that we have is we have an outreach program that we are trying to bring the world together on magic. And so we are a worldwide organization. I just was in I was just in Stockholm, Sweden, with a big convention that was going on there called FISM. And I met some of our worldwide members that I would have never had the opportunity to meet otherwise, from Austria and from Japan. We had a wonderful time, and we talked, and we were automatically, even though we didn't all the way understand each other's languages, we had a great time communicating through our magic. So it's just been a wonderful ride in that sense, to have friends all over the world, to have this one wonderful subject that we deal with, which is just magic itself. And what's really neat about it is that it does bridge all those gaps. So you can understand a magic trick here in America, or you can understand it in Japan, or or Stockholm or whatever the case may be, everybody seems to understand what magic is, and it seems to be an international language.
That was Andy Dallas. In July, he was named president of the Society of American Magicians. If you want to find out more about the group, you can visit their website at www.magicsam.com. Still to come on the program, life as an editor of the personal section, and an audio postcard from the U of I's annual Quad Day. Stay tuned. You've got it tuned to Psytrack. Once a year, a few days before fall classes start at the University of Illinois, student organizations set up booths all along the quad for an event called Quad Day. It's a chance for new and returning students to see what sorts of groups are out there, and it gives the groups a chance to recruit new members. Psytrack's Henry Frain went out to this year's Quad Day and brings us this audio postcard.
My name is Dennis. That's my sword fighting name. And I fight with a group called Numenor, which is just the regional area, and that's for Champaign-Urbana. And the overall organization is called Belagarth. And we just fight with a medieval style using padded foam weapons that have either PVC or fiberglass core. And it's full contact, but we have a lot of rules to make sure it's still safe. So, injuries do happen, but some people get a little excited, might bust a nose, but it's stuff that could happen in any sport. We fight twice a week. We have meetings on Wednesdays, the South Quad, by the Stock Pavilion at 5:30, and on Saturdays, starting at 9, going into like 2 on South Lincoln by the Japan House. And we have people who've been fighting for like 30 years. We have lots of new people all the time, and it's pretty fun.
This is Rob. We're Normal SSDP, which is Students for Sensible Drug Policy. We work to help, we work on drug law reform to help legalize medical cannabis and like spread awareness about things like, about drug policy, like legal medical cannabis and hemp and things like that.
Hello, my name is Deepak Santharaj, and it's not really an organization, but it's a movement on campus called the Broiler Room. And basically what we're doing is committing each other to becoming unified in Christ as ministries on campus come to seek God in the place of prayer. And so what we're doing since last semester is going 24/7 and interceding for the campus and bathing the University of Illinois with the presence of God and just acknowledging that there needs to be unity in Christ, even though there are so many different ministries represented here at the U of I.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline Harris, and I'm a junior at the University of Illinois, and I'm at a booth right now in Quad Day for a group called Body Image Network, and we're a group who meets once a week, and we discuss issues about body image and size diversity, but we also lead our members to become comfortable, and so they could be leaders in leading other discussions towards other groups on campus, such as sorority houses and sporting teams, about the same issues regarding body image and size diversity.
I'm Bridget Garrity. I'm the president of Pride. It's the largest group for queer students on the University of Illinois campus. We meet every week, and we plan events that have educational, political, or social value, basically just to create a welcoming community for all LGBT and ally students.
My name is Action. and what I'm a part of is Chromacoders. What we do is we pretty much make games, and we're focusing on innovative types of games that people help program in teams. And at the end of the year, we release them, you know, for the public. We have some podcasts from other game developers and stuff. I mean, the goal is to really provide an experience for everyone involved in the club to actually learn more about games and where games are going. So it's not just about the traditional games. It's more about the games that are going to happen in the future, you know, the games that are for, like, serious uses, the games that are going to be used for actually learning and all these other things. So that's the goal. CHROMACODERS.org. So, yeah, that's about it. And so we're just recruiting here. We're also trying to expand on to other universities and stuff like that, too.
Hi, my name is Allie Bernstein. I'm a project coordinator for Camp Kesem, which is a nonprofit organization here on campus. It is to plan a free one-week overnight camp for kids ages 6 to 13 in the Champaign-Urbana community. We raise all the funds. We recruit all the students to be counselors and volunteers, and we plan out the entire week of camp. And then in August, we have our one-week overnight camp to provide a fun summer experience for any child who wants to come. It's for ages 6 to 13 who have a parent that has or has had cancer. So if anyone wants to help, come on out and help us. You can contact us at campkesemui@gmail.com.
An audio postcard from this year's Quad Day at the University of Illinois. It was produced by Sidetrack's Henry Frayne. This is Sidetrack. Look in the back section of most newspapers, and you'll find ads containing a series of strange codes, like SWM in search of SWF. These, of course, are the personals, the place where lonely hearts search out one another through print. Michael Beaumier was the personals editor for the Chicago Reader, a weekly alternative newspaper known for its provocative personal section. Beaumier has recently written a book about his experiences. It's titled, I Know You're Out There, Private Longings, Public Humiliations, and Other Tales from the Personals. It's published by Three Rivers Press. I talked with Beaumier recently and asked him this. When people find out he once edited the Personals, what's the first thing they ask him?
Do you know who I am? It actually, in Chicago, that happened quite a bit because a lot of people use the Personals at the Reader. And there were an awful lot of people who I would stumble across who had placed ads, and I had never met them face-to-face. I met a lot of people who placed personals face-to-face. But to kind of connect names with faces was always, it was really fun for me, and it was incredibly, horribly awkward for the people that I met because they, first of all, they didn't really know there was a person who was there reading the personals, making sure that they get put in properly into the paper. And so, you know, you stumble across an awful lot of people who met their wives or husbands or boyfriends or girlfriends or whatever through the Reader. And so that was always really one of the nicest parts of that job for me because, you know, just the sheer number of people who used that service was always amazing to me, always was amazing.
Well, you and your coworkers, you followed this. It was gossip to you. You know, you had a cast of characters.
Of course.
That you watched. Tell us about some of these characters who placed personal ads.
Oh, boy, where do you even start? I mean, it was the whole, you know, width and breadth of Chicago. We had people who were of every age group, some very young people who had just moved to Chicago, and they were looking for somebody to hang around with and to show them around, to very old people who were widows and widowers or who had never been married or whatever, who were just looking for other people who they could get along with. And we had black people, we had white people, we had Atlanta, we had Latin, it was the most amazing cross-section of the world, and that people tended to stay with us for a while, that it would be great if you could do, you know, wrap up your entire love life in one day and clap your hands and have it be all done. But usually people placed ads over a period of time. And so we would watch them as they would kind of, as every new ad would come in, they would say more and more about themselves, who they were, what kind of jobs they had, what their backgrounds were. And, you know, I mean, we would get feedback from a lot of people as to who they were meeting and how it was going. And it was a lot of everybody. And some people are very strange, and some people are really strangely wonderful. I mean, that's the best way of putting it.
Well, I used to read the Chicago Reader all the time, used to read the personal sections. And the one thing about the Chicago Reader and its personals is it was a lot more extreme. You had a really interesting cast of characters, and some of them a little bit weirder than others.
Definitely.
How did you take that when you started working there? Was it a shock?
Well,
did you get used to it?
Well, for me, it was not a shock. For people who were not me, always there was a period of adjustment, shall we say, that I got there after my first writing job had been reviewing pornographic movies. And so by the time I got to the personals, it wasn't old hat, but there was not a lot that could shock me anymore. That people who would ask for incredibly strange things or who were offering very strange things or, you know, were just very strange, that none of that really made me catch my breath. There were a few things that were a little bit too extreme even for us, but it's really important, I think, that there's a place for people to let it all hang out. And the Reader was definitely a kind of newspaper that really sort of welcomed that. I mean, that they were really about, it was such a connection between the people who were placing ads with the people who were reading the paper. And so it's a reflection of the kind of paper the Reader is, that the Reader is a very broad alternative newspaper, alternative to sort of the standard cookie cutter kind of way of people have of approaching love and sex and everything else. We were an alternative paper in the best senses of the word.
Of course, you know, people are always looking to meet up with somebody and find that certain someone. And then you had people who think they saw that someone across a crowded room but never said anything, and then, you know, put ads in your paper, you know, asking for those missed connections. Tell us about the story of this one guy who seemed to fall in love everywhere he went.
Well, he was a very interesting man, and we'll call him Bill because that's his name. and Bill was certainly not alone in terms of being somebody who would put in advertisements all the time for people that he saw and was too afraid to approach. But he was really remarkable in that, from all outside purposes, you know, from the way that he seemed, he was not a mouse. He was not shy. He didn't seem like somebody who was a complete introvert. He seemed like a completely normal, cool guy. Somebody who, I think that the way that I felt about him was that any woman who he would approach would actually be sort of charmed by him. But he was too terrified to even get to the point where he would talk to any of these women that he saw. And he would send advertisements all the time. He was somebody who I would get 3 advertisements in a week from him that he would talk about somebody that he'd seen on the L, at the movies, and in a bookstore, and that he would describe them in detail. As time went on and he placed more ads, he knew how to do it. He would just be excruciatingly detailed with what these women were wearing, how their hair fell across their face, and he was very poetic. And, And it was just a little bit out of hand. he was a really good guy who just needed to have the courage to kind of find somebody. And it was really hard to kind of have a conversation with him about it. And so I finally just wrote a letter of recommendation. Came to the offices, and I gave him this letter, and I said, print out as many copies as you need and start handing them to women on the subway and women in the bookstores and women in, you know, the movies. And the letter was more or less me telling whoever was reading it that if they didn't go out to coffee with this fellow or take his phone number, that I was going to end up getting an advertisement from them anyway, and they could save us both a lot of trouble and just, you know, be nice to this guy. And I gave my name and my phone number at the Reader for them to call.
Yeah,
it worked. It worked perfectly well. It was great.
I love it because you actually reprint the letter here on page 40 and 41. And, yeah, you go, please, please, please save us a lot of trouble and let this man buy you a cup of coffee. He was just
He was a good guy. I wouldn't have unleashed some crazy person on you know, unsuspecting strangers that I was never going to meet, you know, without believing in them. And with a lot of people who placed the ads, who I got to know, that I really did believe in them. I think that there's a lot of nobility in putting yourself out there and saying, okay, I'm going to look for something. I know something that I need, and I know there's something that I want, and I'm going to find it. So, I mean, you have to respect that. It's pretty cool.
Well, at one point, you start playing matchmaker. Since you get to know these people, you start playing matchmaker. Although,
well,
go ahead.
You can't really just let, you know, fate unfold without a push sometimes.
But the thing is, for you, those didn't turn out very well.
No, those turned out horribly. That whenever anybody asked me to do this in my adult life, because once you have this job, that's what people ask you to do constantly, is matchmake. And I am really upfront and clear in the fact that my record is just plain bad. I'm really a bad matchmaker. But my criteria was always, I think the underlying thing was, how much trouble can I get in by setting these two people up on a date? And the answer was, there's a lot of trouble. That you'd have people who'd call and say, well, that worked out horribly. Why did you set me up with that? There was a bakery chef and this woman who was sort of obsessed with Atkins that I set up together, and that was really bad. That was a really bad match. He liked flour, and she wouldn't eat anything. But you try.
Besides, you know, people meeting through the personal ads, your paper actually put on a few singles parties so that people could get together in a bar and hopefully mingle and find that certain someone. But again, these things didn't always turn out the way you would think it would.
Oh, they never turned out the way that you think that they would. In the ideal, you expect equal numbers of men and women who are well-dressed and who have clean fingernails and who show up and they're charming and they get along well and there's flirtatiousness and there's energy and there's this attraction. And what we ended up getting, we'd get 12 guys and one fairly crazy woman sometimes. Sometimes we had some really, really wonderful people who showed up at those parties, but they were wonderful to us. They weren't wonderful to each other, mostly. But those parties back in the day, this was a while ago, that those parties were pretty bad.
Tell me about the Sumo Twins.
Yes, they're these two ladies who would show up in their own handmade clothing, and that they were very there was a lot of charm whenever they were around. They were fun people.
But they would bring their own trash bags and devastate the buffet.
They would take the food. They would take the occasionally. I believe there was a party where we actually had like plants on tables. You know, the little table setting thing, and those were gone too. Their pockets would be filled with whatever they could find, right down to sugar packets. It was pretty amazing. those parties for me were a great deal of fun, but I think for the people who went, they were not so great.
Well, you know, putting an ad in the personals is a risky thing because, like you said, you're putting yourself out there, and who knows what's going to come back at you.
Yes. You might find yourself in the morning, you know, chained to someone's radiator. It's a risky business, but, you know, that's the way dating is no matter how you do it. Internet the same way. Your friends might set you up with somebody who may seem really very nice but has a lot of, you know, raw meat hanging around his living room, that sort of thing. Interesting people in the world.
Now, how did working in the personals affect your private life? Was it hard to leave it all at the office?
Well, the thing that was sort of bad was that I was in the midst of probably the world's longest breakup during the time that I was working in the personals. And that it was, I believe it was a 9-year breakup. We dated for 6 months and we broke up for 9 years. And that so you'd have this sort of interesting habit of going to work and kind of having to clear your head and realize, you know, that people still do want this falling in love thing, no matter, you know, how badly it may be going for me at home. But that going back, it was very hard. I mean, I think that it's very hard to make relationships work, and you need to have a lot of stamina. And you need to have a lot of stamina when you break up, too, because sometimes it takes a while.
It seems like you can become very cynical, especially, as you said, you were in a bad, failing relationship, and then you have all these people coming at you looking for love and the Prince Charming and, you know, the perfect life, and, you know, you're looking at them, and it's like, well, no, this doesn't exist. I mean, how did you work that?
Well, but the thing about it is that it does exist, but it is an incredible amount of work. And you hear that as a cliche. My whole life, really, working in the personals, is cliche after cliche after cliche, because that's what people use when they talk about love. But, you know, things are cliches for a reason, and a lot of cliches are really true. And I have to say that I understand sort of the risk of falling into cynicism when you're in a bad relationship and your job is to help people find love. But I have to tell you, I think that it was really very helpful to be able to go into a place, you know, 40 hours a week, 50 hours a week, however long I was there, and see these people who were really making an effort to find this thing and that were really very adamant about its existence and its ability to make you happy. And far from being cynical, I thought it was fantastic. That I always admired the people who placed the personals because I thought, you know, they're still trying, they're still looking, and that's a really fantastic, wonderful thing. It didn't make me think like, oh, these people are a bunch of losers. And I know a lot of people who look at personals in newspapers and online dating and J-Date and Match.com and singles events and speed dating and matchmakers and that whole magilla of things that's supposed to help you find that special someone, that I know there's a lot of looking down at those people and kind of dismissing them as losers. And I just don't think that's the case. I think it's the exact opposite. I think those people are fantastic. I'm very, you know, and I never stopped admiring them. I thought it was a really positive thing that people continue to do that.
Well, especially in a huge metropolitan area like Chicago, where there are, you know, you walk downtown Chicago and there's hundreds and hundreds of faces, and, you know, that you'll anonymous.
They're very cute.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. And yes, anonymous.
Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to sort of cast out your line metaphorically to find that perfect catch.
Yes. And that stops a lot of people. There are a lot of people that are so intimidated by the odds of finding somebody and of how do you find somebody in a world that's this big and confusing and you have all of this information flowing at you all the time and everyone is incredibly busy, and that to stop and say, okay, I'm going to say who I am. I'm going to say what I want. I'm going to describe who I'm looking for. I'm going to cross my fingers and I'm going to throw the bottle out into the ocean.
There's also something really, really charming about putting a personal in the newspaper and that print as opposed to online on a, you know, on a monitor, wherever. There's something very immediate and visceral about seeing that, you know, in print with the ink and everything.
Oh, yeah.
Something wonderfully charming about that sort of anachronism. But by the end of the book, that's even changing because your newspaper, The Reader, was starting to do more stuff online. Even the process where people would bring in the ads or call in the ads, well, that became automated.
Yes, and I have to tell you that it's really hard to express sort of how I feel about it because it's two incredibly separate feelings. And the first feeling that I have is, well, it was inevitable. And that the inevitability of it is that that's the way of the future is the Internet, and that's just the way that it's going to be. And it's very easy, and it's also very convenient. And people like ease, and they like convenience, and you don't want to deny them those things. But the feeling other than that is to really be sad to see something go away that really for hundreds of years has been around. And that feeling is much more personal. It's not about what the people get or what the people want as much as how I feel about it. And it's a very selfish thing, but the thing about the personals that I always really loved was the fact that there they were. I mean, you had a column in the newspaper that were all the men who were looking for all the women. And within that column, you had everybody. You had the Christians, you had the Jews, you had the Muslims, you had people who were one age or another age, or you had people of different races, and you had people of different backgrounds or different economic level, and that it was this mishmash of all of the people who were looking for the same thing in a very simple kind of way. And they were all together in one place, and they were in that newspaper, and the newspaper was a group of people from a lot of different places who were getting together who were writing or editing or selling advertisements or managing. And what you get now is you put in your criteria. You put in what you want. You say that I'm looking for a good Christian girl who graduated from college, who is white, who makes this much money, and that you only see those people that you kind of pick out. And all those other people are lost, that you don't see them. They don't exist because you didn't even think that you might be looking for something different than these criteria that you've put in. And that's sad to me. I think it's too bad that people don't get as much experience in any other realm like that. So, but I could go on and on and wax nostalgic, but, you know, you just have to give yourself up to the technology of the future.
That was Michael Beaumier, author of I Know You're Out There, Private Longings, Public Humiliations, and Other Tales from the Personals. It's published by Three Rivers Press. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL Urbana.